coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. A major revitalization project is coming to Wilmington's Northeast Riverside neighborhood.
It's an ambitious project, and it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of money.
Delaware Public Media contributor Larry Nagengast joins us to offer an in-depth look at this plan. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We'll also look at the impact the restoration project at Prime Hook National Wildlife Refuge is having in and around the refuge. Our latest arts playlist tells us what the historic Odessa Foundation has in store for its annual holiday tour and exhibit. And Enlighten Me introduces us to a local artist who's getting national attention for his takes on viral memes and pop culture icons. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Earlier this month, we reported on the announcement of a major revitalization project coming to Wilmington's Northeast Riverside neighborhood. The plan over the next decade is to transform Riverside by addressing housing, education, and community resource needs. We actually saw the first hints of what may be coming to the neighborhood in contributor Larry Nagengast's piece on the proposed teen warehouse back in October. With more of the plan now on the table, we asked Larry to give us a more in-depth overview of this ambitious plan. And you can find that in his new piece available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me earlier this week to delve into the plan's various pieces.
First, in broad strokes, what is the plan trying to accomplish? What will we see happening in Riverside going forward?
Okay, well, first of all, a couple of basics about Riverside. It's a low-income, predominantly African-American neighborhood in the northeast section of Wilmington. There are about 700 housing units there. Roughly 300 of them are public housing run by the Wilmington Housing Authority. Using 2010 census data, almost all of the 4,000-plus residents in the community are living in poverty. Per capita income in the area was less than $9,000. Nearly 40% of the adults had not completed high school, and only 1 in 8 adult males, had jobs. This is 2010 data. Reach Riverside, which is a new redevelopment organization, is going to try to change that. Some of the key components of the plan are these. Building about 400 new housing units, some subsidized and some at market rate, to replace those 300 WHA units. Replacing the community's hub, the aging Kingswood Community Center, with a modern building. Expanding the Eastside Charter School to include high school grades and creating a new emphasis on community wellness. And through it all, building a new core of leaders within the community. It's an ambitious project, and it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of money.
And as we noted when we talked about the teen warehouse concept that's part of this earlier this fall, there is a great deal of local support behind this initiative. How broad is that? Who's involved in trying to make all this stuff happen?
Well, okay, we've got many of the same players as in the teen warehouse and a lot more. You've got the state. You've got Wilmington City government. You've got Newcastle County as government. On top of that, also on board, University of Delaware and Delaware State University, and, of course, the Wilmington Housing Authority. And then if you look at some of the individuals who were serving on the board of directors, These are real strong leaders. Delaware State University's Provost Tony Allen, Rob Buccini, who's the leading real estate developer in the city, Gary Stockbridge, the president of Delmarva Power, and about a half dozen other government and civic leaders, both past and present.
But there's also an outside group involved here now. Who is that, and what are they bringing to the table?
I'm going to say this, this is really the X factor in the project and what's really going to make it go. It's the Atlanta-based organization that's called Purpose Built Communities. And as nonprofits go, it has deep pockets. Founders and board members in this organization include Atlanta developer and philanthropist Tom Cousins, billionaire investor Warren Buffett. I mean, everybody's heard of him, as well as former hedge fund manager Julian Robertson. Purpose-Built Communities provides consulting services and technical assistance to redevelopment groups that want to work according to their model. And that model is one that's based on improving housing and education and improving, strengthening community health and wellness. All of these are key components components of the Riverside plan. Most importantly, they provide these services for up to 10 years, and they do it for free. That's right, F-R-E-E, free. Purpose Built Communities has 19 other affiliates nationwide. So in addition to having one of its consultants essentially on call or just an email away, Reach Riverside will get to meet with leaders in other communities that are using the same redevelopment model. They can call on each other, share their expertise, get advice, and get support.
And it looks like the first piece of the initiative is going to be the housing part. What is that expected to look like? How is that going to roll out?
Okay, well, we don't know a whole lot in terms of the, you know, the real details here until the spring. The next couple of months are going to be spent putting together what's known as a master development plan. But we can safely say that the housing part of this development is going to be phased in. They'll probably start with 100 or 120 of the planned 400 units. The first units will most likely be built on vacant land across the street from the current Riverside housing, so Riverside residents can move into the new homes before their old units are demolished. Also, while rents were subsidized at the Wilmington Housing Authority unit, the goal here is to have about 30% of the new units rented at market rate. So this is going to make some change in the overall demographics of the community as well. As for construction, you can anticipate that the first phase of construction will probably start early in 2020, so less than 18 months from now.
How about the other pieces? What are the tentative plans for them at this point?
Well, first of all, quick update on Teen Warehouse. You know, when we talked a couple of weeks ago, I said the Capital One Bank had been asked to donate the old Prestige Academy Charter School building for use as the Teen Warehouse Service Center site. And at the time, Capital One was being cautious about what it said. I think at the time they were still looking at, well, maybe they can sell the building rather than give it away. Well, this week I've been told that Capital One will make the donation and that the paperwork is supposed to be wrapped up by the end of the year. Again, no official announcement yet, but the folks involved with Reach Riverside and the Teen Warehouse, and there's a lot of overlap there, you know, say that official announcement will come in early January after the paperwork is completed.
How about some of the other things, the education piece and the community center?
Well, okay, if you look at the education piece, the community center, Eastside Charter School, probably 3-4 years away from anything happening there. I talked to Charlie McDowell, who's head of the Reach Riverside Board and had spent 12 years on the board of directors for the charter school. And he says, you know, they still want to do a little bit more in terms of amping up the current academic programs there before they're ready to move into expansion into the high school grades. So that's 3-4 years down the road. As far as the Kingswood Community Center goes, the plan there, much like the housing, is going to be build a new facility, probably behind or you know, pretty much adjoining where the current building is. Once the new building is up, tear the old one down. And again, as part of this master development plan that's in the works, they're going to try to figure out exactly what the amenities are, what kind of services. They've got a senior center there, a child care and all that. They're going to continue that, but you know, there may be others. Again, there's a UD partnership here. UD may want to move in there and provide some health and wellness services as well. So they're looking at all of those possibilities, figuring out what's going to go into the new Kingswood, and then no timeline yet on construction, but I would suspect that's probably going to get going around the same time as the housing, maybe a little bit after that.
Let's talk dollars and cents. The price tag being thrown out there is about $100 million. Where is that coming from?
Well, that's a good question. Nobody really knows for sure. Logan Herring, who has been Kingswood's executive director and now is heading the Reach Riverside project, says that price tag is kind of a back-of-the-envelope estimate. So it could be more, it could be less. Herring says that the WHA and Penrose LLC, which is the developer chosen for the project, are going to be applying in April to the state for low-income housing tax credits. So that's going to cover some of the costs. Now, as the project evolves, you're going to see you hope to see anyway, private investors coming in, particularly on that Northeast Boulevard strip, which is ripe for redevelopment for retail and commercial properties. Beyond that, you're going to see them going to, well, the usual suspects in Delaware, hitting up the big banks and other big corporations for contributions, as well as the foundations, Longwood and Welfare, Laffey, McHugh, and the like. On top of that, they're going to start interviewing consultants who do work in fundraising on a national basis. Then they're hoping that the consultant that they do hire is going to be able to write some grant proposals that's going to bring in some funds from foundations that have a national reputation. And so money coming in, hopefully coming in from all sorts of places. You know, exactly how the numbers fit together, not sure yet. But this is a long project.
What's the community reaction been so far?
One of the things that's been kind of interesting is that Logan Herring and his board of directors have been having meetings with the community before they've had a couple of major announcements and preliminary sessions with the big guns in the Wilmington Delaware power structure. So they're keeping residents pretty well informed at this point. If you look at the history of the Riverside community, these are folks who have been used to being marginalized, being beaten down, not necessarily having their interests heard or respected. This seems to be a little bit different process, and I think as long as they keep the residents involved and make them a genuine part of the planning process, the support is going to continue to be there.
I also found it interesting that Mayor Mike Brzezicki drew comparisons to the Wilmington Riverfront when talking about this project. What's he saying?
Again, when I was talking to the mayor the other day, I couldn't resist. I just had to ask him this because he had been as the head of the Riverfront Development Corporation for more than 20 years, and the Riverfront project is, 25 years old at this point. Well, and he's not saying that this is going to be a piece of cake by any stretch of the imagination, but he did say it's not going to be nearly as difficult as the Riverfront. I mean, in Brzezicki's view, the Riverfront project has been around for 25 years, and he's looking at it and saying, it's really not even half done yet. I mean, they finished one side of the river, and they haven't really done a whole lot on the other. So in comparison, this one is a smaller project and probably more manageable in that context. But it's still it's quite big. And Brzezicki says, what you've got to do here is you've got to take this one step at a time. You can't try to bite off too much too quickly, which is why, again, the housing is going to start with 100, 120 rather than all 400 units. Now, I mean, the other thing that it's kind of interesting about this. I mean, if you remember, there were times during the course of the Riverfront development where people were saying, "Hey, the people in the neighborhoods, all the parts of Wilmington, were saying, this isn't about me. This isn't going to help me a whole lot. This is all about supporting the businesses and the developers, rather than the ordinary folks in town." Brzezicki, is quite clear about talking about the importance of building strong neighborhoods, not just in Riverside, but in other parts of the city as well. And so he's saying, we've got to take it a little bit of the time. We've got to pay attention to the residents. We've got to recognize that they've been marginalized, not always listened to in the past, and we can't allow that sort of thing to continue. And quite frankly, if the residents can work together with the folks who hold the big bucks and who make and are part of the established power structure in the city and the state, if all these groups can work together, I'd say there's a real good chance that good things are going to happen here.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. His piece on the planned Riverside Revitalization Project is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And next, Delaware Public Media contributor John Hurdle heads back to Prime Hope National Wildlife Refuge to tell us the impact the restoration project there is having after just a few years. Stay with us. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. 2 years after work ended on the $38 million restoration of the Prime Hook National Wildlife Refuge, the biggest project of its kind on the East Coast is already achieving its goal of restoring habitat for migratory birds and other wildlife. And officials believe in remaking the preserve, they've also managed to create a system that takes into account sea level rise in a way the marsh can sustain itself, at least for the next few decades, as ocean waters rise. Contributor John Hurdle recently visited Prime Hook to get a firsthand look at the results of the restoration and the impact it's had. He details what he found in his latest piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me recently to discuss what he learned. So just to get people back up to speed, can you give us a quick thumbnail sketch of what work was actually done at Prime Hook during this whole restoration?
Well, sure. The overall plan was to reduce the flooding in the reserve, and the way they did that was first of all, they wanted to fill the breaches in a line of dunes that separates the reserve from the Delaware Bay. These breaches had opened up, four or five of them, starting in with a series of storms in 2006. There were other storms subsequently, and they're punctuated by Hurricane Sandy, of course, in 2012. So there was a lot of bay water getting into the refuge that shouldn't have been. So filling the breaches was a major part of what they did. They also dug a series of channels to help to drain the water out of the reserve. They removed a series of water barriers which had stopped the water draining out in and out with the tides, and they built up the beach and the dune, and the beach has been engineered in such a way that it absorbs the impact of the waves from the bay rather than becoming some kind of a sharp barrier that the bay kind of pounds against. And then crucially, the other part of this whole restoration is to build up the marshes behind on the western side of the reserve, and the reason for that is to encourage the regrowth of vegetation, which will itself become a barrier to the encroaching seas.
And as you noted, the primary goal was really to deal with these dune breaches and the flooding that had plagued the area, not just the reserve, but the surrounding neighborhoods and areas previously. How has that part of the project worked out so far?
Well, officials say it's working quite well. Construction ended about 2 years ago, and they're saying that they had expected that they were going to have to wait 5 to 8 years in order to really tell whether this project was working. They now say they're ahead of schedule and that there are very good signs that the whole project is going to achieve its goals. And the principal indication of that is a lower water level. And so one effect of that is that exposes mudflats at low tide, and the mudflats allow the regrowth of native vegetation, and it also invites in various wildlife. And there's indications outside the reserve, actually, that this is quite successful. And there's an isolated beach community down there called Prime Hook Beach on a very narrow barrier island, and there's one road in and out of that. And for years, Prime Hook Beach, the residents there had been cut off regularly, several times a month. Their only access road got flooded over, and that I'm told hasn't happened now for the last 2 years since this construction project finished. And there's a number of reasons for that. One is that there's lower water levels in the reserve itself. But also DelDOT built a bridge along part of that road to elevate the road. And then they also, created some large culverts that facilitated the flow of water between the different parts of the reserve. So So that has helped the residents of Primal Beach feel a whole lot better about this whole project.
And as you said in your piece, that the project kind of took a different approach, and it's one that didn't just look at these current issues that we've talked about, but also took future sea level rise into account. How did the project accomplish that?
Really, it did so by assuming that sea level rise is a fact of life, and that the only way that this project was going to succeed was by creating a system that adapted to the inevitability, if you like, of seas rising. Now, we've all heard forecasts about 3 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century, 10% of Delaware's land being inundated. Some forecasts are for higher levels than that. And so what the architects of this of the Prime Hook project assumed that even though they built up the beach and the dunes, which for now will prevent the waters of the Delaware Bay getting into the refuge in such volumes, the officials there are assuming that as seas rise and we get these bigger storms that are forecast with climate change, then inevitably there's going to be some of those are going to wash over the top of that new beach and the new dune, and that and the silt and the sand that's brought with that are going to deposit themselves on the rebuilt marsh on the western side of the reserve, which will sustain itself and it'll build itself up, and that will help to defend the western side of the reserve and the integrity of the refuge overall.
Having said that, what are the prospects for this approach dealing long term with rising seas?
The folks at Prime Hook are very candid about that, and they say that they can only really plan 30 years out, and for a sea level rise expectation of about half a meter during that time. And, you know, they're very candid in the sense that they have no illusions that this represents a permanent solution to the flooding in the reserve, but they're saying that over the next 30 years, their expectation is that the reserve will be able to function, albeit not in exactly the way that it does at the moment, but that it will be able to function as the coastline moves inexorably westwards.
And we've talked a lot, obviously, about the success of this project and what the officials are hopeful about. Let's look at the flip side. What are the limitations of this project? You know, where is it not going to be able to maybe do what one may or may not hope?
Well, I think the answer to that, Tom, is simply in the expectation that seas will continue to rise. And, of course, there are increasing reports on a global level that climate change is happening quicker than previously expected, and consequently global sea levels are rising, increasing reports about melting ice caps, and of course all of those circumstances create more problems for the mid-Atlantic coast, because the land is sinking at the same time as the seas are rising, and the net result of that is that areas like the Delaware Shore are experiencing about twice the level of sea level rise that, in comparison with the global rate.
We've heard in the past this project could serve as a model for others elsewhere. Based on these early results, is it fair to say that remains the case?
Yes, I mean the folks at Prime Hook are optimistic that this will be adapted, and one of the and some of the evidence for that, they say, is that the Army Corps of Engineers is beginning to take this idea of adaptation to sea level rise more seriously. The Army Corps, of course, does a great deal of work along coastlines. For example, the replenishment of beaches in places like Bethany Beach and Rehoboth. And the approach that they typically take, I believe, is that they will rebuild a dune that effectively becomes a seawall. And what the folks at Prime Hook are saying is that building a seawall, even if it's made of sand, is eventually doomed to failure because of sea level rise. And so what you've got to do instead is to take a whole different approach and design a system that is based on the idea of adaptation rather than resistance.
You also alluded to earlier that this work has had a pretty noticeable impact on wildlife in the area. Can you give us a little bit more detail on the changes they're seeing in that area right now?
Well, yes, and this is one of the indications of success that the prime hook folks are particularly excited about. They point to there's a species of shorebird called the piping plover, which is a quite a rare bird in Delaware, and until the last couple of years had only been present as a breeding species at Cape Henlopen State Park in quite small numbers. This year, 12 pairs of these birds nested on the new beach at Prime Hook and fledged 29 young, which is a state record. They also talk about there's a number of different fish species that are coming back up into the channels because they now have recreated suitable habitat for them. And probably the most visible indication of the success of this project is acres of this brown marsh grass called Spartina alterniflora, which is a native species. It's been given a bit of a jump start by seeding, but what I'm told is that essentially now that the project has re-exposed the mudflats where this grass can grow, it's spontaneously come back. And so if you stand on the new Del Dot Bridge at Prime Hook Road and look east towards the community of Prime Hook itself, you can see acres of this grass standing in an area which was previously just open water. And, of course, that's good for the community because it protects their shoreline.
And speaking of the community, what are advocates and neighbors saying about what they're seeing?
Well, I talked to one couple who was walking on the beach, in fact, right on an area of the new dune that was previously underwater, which was previously part of the Delaware Bay. They say they've been coming here for years, and they had noticed that the bird population dropped off when the reserve was quite badly flooded. And now in the last couple of years, they say the birds are coming back. So of course they're very happy to see that. And local residents who are no longer having to deal with the flooding, of course, are very happy with that as well.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time on The Green this week. His piece on the restoration of Prime Hook National Wildlife Refuge is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next, our arts playlist tells us what the historic Odessa Foundation has planned for its annual holiday tour and exhibition. But first, your local headlines from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol has captured the imagination of audiences around the world with its story of redemption and holiday joy. Ebenezer Scrooge sees the light and puts aside his miserly ways after surviving visits from the ghost of Jacob Marley and the Christmas spirits of past, present, and future. The historic Odessa Foundation is using this holiday season to celebrate the 175th anniversary of the Dickens classic through its annual Christmas holiday tour and special exhibit running through December 30th. In this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele chats with Debbie Buxton, the historic Odessa Foundation's executive director, about the tour and the exhibit.
This holiday season, the HOF, the Historic Odessa Foundation, is going to be having a Dickens of a Christmas as they celebrate the 175th anniversary of Charles Dickens' indelible classic, A Christmas Carol, in prose being a ghost story of Christmas, which was first published all the way back in 1843. Debbie, thank you for joining me. Talk to me about this.
Oh, this is such a exciting time at Historic Odessa each and every year. We've been doing this now for about 35 years. We make a complete departure from our regular interpretation of the families that lived in our buildings, and we recreate A Christmas Story. And this is one of our very favorites. We have done it before. We did it about 34 years ago. I think it was the first or second story that we ever did, and it's an all-time favorite. I mean, who just doesn't love The Christmas Carol? So it's a long tradition here in Odessa of recreating these stories and promoting children's literature and promoting literacy. We work in conjunction with our local library, the Corbett Calloway Library, to offer ongoing programming throughout the month of December for children. We do storybook times. We have a tea for children that is really just just wonderful. That's on December 9th. We have just storybook time December 5th and 11th. Just lots of fun, lots of things to do. This is a real family event, and, you know, we love having children. This year, in our 244-year-old Corbett Sharp House, we will be creating vignettes and transforming the house into the world of Ebenezer Scrooge with depictions of his counting house, his lodgings, the festive Mr. Fezziwig's ball, the house of Tiny Tim, of course, and the parlor of Scrooge's nephew Fred, along with the cemetery. So you will have Christmas present, Christmas past, and Christmas future all in attendance at this year's great holiday tour.
Well, I can't wait to attend. So take us back. How did this get started? You mentioned 35 years now. How did it first get started?
Well, it got started because every year the Women's Club in the town of Odessa has a tour of private homes. And 35 years ago, in the spirit of community partnership, we would open our buildings on that day for their tour. And our families were Quaker, and Quakers didn't celebrate Christmas. It was just more or less like any other day. And so, you know, it was historically inaccurate for us to have Christmas decorations in the houses. And the audience was upset. You know, they wanted to see Christmas. So we put our thinking caps on and thought, well, how can we do this and, you know, give a good interpretation that is a historical interpretation of Christmas traditions while not sending out an interpretive message that just never happened here in our buildings. So we decided to recreate stories. And we've done so many over the years. We've done all the Frances Hodgson Burnett books, The Secret Garden. We've done Little Lord Fauntleroy. We've done Louisa May Alcott. We've, of course, have done Charles Dickens. We've done Clement Moore. So we've done tons of stories over the years. And it's a lot of fun for staff because it's outside of what we normally do. We get really creative, and everyone joins in and has a great time. Everybody has an opinion about how we can, how we can recreate these stories, and it all lends to creating this really wonderful, wonderful tour. And the whole site is involved because we're a large site. We have four buildings that are open for tour, and those include the landmark, National Historic Landmark Corbett Sharp House, which was built in 1774, our Wilson Warner House, which is slightly earlier than that on the National Register of Historic Places. It dates 1769, and this year we'll have our Storybook Trees exhibit in that house. So we invite the public to sign up to decorate a tree. They get to select the book. We provide the tree and the lights, and then there is a time frame where they come in and decorate the trees with their families. And then those trees are on exhibit throughout the month of December. So in addition to seeing the storybook house where the carol will be, you also get to see the wonderful Storybook Trees exhibition. And then in our Colin Sharp House, which dates to 1700, and it's one of the oldest houses in the state of Delaware, we have festive foods every Saturday throughout the month, and our visitors can see 18th century open hearth cooking, where we're creating foods that would have been served at special occasions in the 18th century. And these foods are being historically prepared using the tools and techniques of the period, and people can even pick up recipes to try at home. Oftentimes, I think people have this vision of 18th century food as sort of one-pot stews and corn cakes on the hearth. But the truth is that if you were from a fairly wealthy or substantial household, the foods were really quite sophisticated. So it's a great treat to see these things being created, and it's truly a step back in time. I mean, this town is like magic, and it's especially magical at Christmas.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like it. You know, families from far and near get together for the holidays. The holidays are coming up very quickly. We're talking to Debbie Buxton. Debbie is the executive director of the Historic Odessa Foundation. So what can people expect who are visiting for the 175th anniversary of Charles Dickens?
Well, they can expect a wonderful tour. A great activity during the holidays, great place to bring family and friends and out-of-town visitors. The total tour takes about 2 hours to see everything that we have. Visitors start at our visitor center located in the historic Odessa Bank at 201 Main Street, where they're ticketed, and they begin their tour with a guide. So it is a guided tour. We have special activities for families with children, where the children actually make a Christmas activity, and it's lots of fun. We're really geared for the whole family. There's something for everyone. Throughout the month of December, on Tuesdays and Thursday evenings, we offer candlelight tours, which are wonderful. I mean, it's a treat to see these houses lit at night and to come through, and really get a feeling of what life was like before electricity. It's charming. It's just great. We have a special curator candlelight tour on December 20th, which is led by our curator that has created the exhibit in the Corbett House, Brian Miller. He does a fabulous job every year. He outdoes himself every year. We laugh and I tell him, oh, this year is definitely my favorite. It just gets better and better. And he'll offer that tour on December 20th twice. Once at 5 p.m. and once at 7 p.m. These are by reservation, so people will need to call and make a reservation to attend candlelight tours. And they can go to our website, historicodessa.org, look at our calendar of events, and get the full, the full look at everything we're offering throughout the holiday season. It's just a great tradition. And we have people that come year after year that just, they look forward to bringing their families to see the exhibit each and every year. Our admission is $10 for adults. It's $8 for groups, seniors, and students. And members and children under 6 are free. Tickets and information can always be found at our website, or you can call us at 302-378-4119, which is our public information number. And our website is www.historicodessa.org.
Debbie Buxton, you're just a wealth of information. I'm looking forward to this. The Historic Odessa Foundation, it sounds like the place to be for the holidays this year. What else? You've given us a lot. What else are we leaving out, though?
Well, you can make an afternoon of it. You can come. We have a wonderful restaurant here called Cantwell's Tavern, which is also decorated for the holiday season. The museum also does the decorations at Cantwell's. They have a great menu. It's a great place to eat. And the proceeds from the tavern help to support the Historic Odessa Foundation's preservation efforts in Odessa. So it's an important piece of what we do here, because it helps us really to protect and preserve this wonderful, wonderful colonial town. And, Odessa's special. There isn't another site in the state quite like it. It really is a pristine colonial townscape. And, all the exterior buildings are decorated. I mean, just walking around town, looking at the decorations inspires you to go home and start your own decorating. We have very creative people who do fabulous wreaths and lamppost swags and window swags. I mean, it's like Williamsburg. And the homeowners, I mean, the people who own private homes, they're just as enthusiastic. So you see this throughout the town, not just the museum buildings, but the exteriors of all the private homes are also decorated. And it's really quite breathtaking.
Our thanks to Debbie Buxton, Executive Director of the Historic Odessa Foundation, and our Kelly Steele for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. You can learn more about the Historic Odessa Foundation's holiday schedule at historicodessa.org. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where our Sophia Schmidt introduces us to a local artist getting national attention for his surrealist takes on viral memes and pop culture icons. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. We close this week's show with the latest edition of Enlighten Me, where we hear from local artist Aleem Smith. The Wilmington native has gained national attention for his surrealist takes on viral memes and pop culture icons. And for this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talked to Smith about his newest project, creating what he calls urban mythology.
Disneyland, or no, it would look like all of your favorite cartoons in mystical worlds with black people in them.
That's how painter Aleem Smith describes his style, Afro-surrealism. The Wilmington native went viral last year for his renditions of popular memes. He's also painted the likes of Snoop Dogg and Erykah Badu, what he says Black History Month might look like from a millennial's perspective. He says he's moving away from portraiture now and toward visual folklore. Smith's only formal training was at Cab Calloway School of the Arts in Wilmington. I asked him how he found his style.
It started with MC Escher. He is my absolute favorite artist because I feel like he is a perfect mix of creativity and skill. And that's what I'm aiming for. It's mostly MC Escher and Dolly. I just love how they twisted reality. It feels very natural. I appreciate it. Because I don't really, growing up in art school, I didn't really like art that much, like the art that they showed us. Because it was very blah. It was just, okay, it's a picture. Because art is a very hard art form to really grab someone's attention with. You really have to paint something very interesting. You really have to play with colors. You really have to make someone's eyes move around the page. Because most of the time, people are just going to look at your picture for a couple seconds. So I just wanted to create art that would make people stop for at least 10 seconds.
The internet has played a pivotal role in Smith's career as an artist. He says he's able to support himself financially by selling prints online and doing commissions. Much of his success started last year when his meme series went viral. He was interviewed in several national news outlets, including Time.
I think mostly it just made me more confident in my ideas because I wasn't doing it to go viral, get a lot of attention. I had a pattern. I was just going to drop a different series during Black History Month every year. It made me feel like I was an actual artist because I was being posted everywhere. I was like, okay, if I was playing before, now I'm actually an artist. I have to like go with this thing. Because I was just painting pictures because I never felt like I did or created what I felt like I considered art yet. So it made me just take a second and not rush on my next work.
Smith says he feels his quick rise in recognition affected the quality of his art.
A lot of my art so far has been rushed. Like the meme series, I started that, and it started catching attention before I even knew all of the memes I was going to paint. I was just uploading work. I was making those in like 2 or 3 days. I wasn't putting like actual time, and thought and consideration into the pieces.
Smith appreciates how the internet has allowed him to be independent as an artist, not dependent on the traditional centers of power in the industry, like the gallery scene. But he says the internet has its downsides.
The internet, I feel like, has really washed down and watered down art, and a lot of people are in a rush to upload things just to be like, I'm creating. But none of the greats had that pressure. No, like, inspirational artists who have gone down in history had the pressure of like, I need to upload something every day so you know that I paint. Because it waters down the work. It takes away from the work. I just really want to push the envelope. I just really want to do something. Like, I don't care if people like it as much. I just want to do something that is, oh, okay, wow, that's different.
He says the intense and ubiquitous nature of the internet inspires the surrealism in his work.
There's not a lot of representation for weird black stuff. But black people are weird too. We have crazy ideas too. Like, we're not just listening to rap and just not thinking about the future, and not thinking about artificial intelligence. We're thinking about all of that stuff and how it will affect us and how we look in those realities and how we create our own realities.
And with his current series, Smith is building what he calls urban mythology.
There are no stories for the African-American experience, or like folklore type stories. That doesn't exist. We just got Jesus and different religions, but we don't have any things that relate to us and describe us and that originate from us. So that's my focus, is just creating a story around what already exists and like adding value to it, adding value to do-rags, making a whole legend behind do-rags and not just it being a thing that just happened out of nowhere.
Smith says one painting in this series draws on imagery from his youth in Wilmington.
Have you ever drank a Mystic? It's a terrible drink. It's delicious, and it's mostly in corner stores. It's terrible, but it's a beautiful bottle. So I have this painting of a genie coming out of a Mystic bottle.
And another work that's still in progress.
There's one piece of an eight-armed drummer named 808. Because everybody loves the 808 drum. But it doesn't have a history. It has a history, but it doesn't have like a bigger, grander, like Greek mythology type history to it. Like, so it's this black dude who has eight arms, who plays drums, and there's a whole parade of people following behind him, and he is the god of music.
Smith currently splits his time among Wilmington, Philadelphia, and Newark, New Jersey, but he says his hometown has helped his creative process.
It's not a lot of things to do. You're not distracted by a whole bunch of parties or some celebrities coming. There's nothing really happening here. So it's a great place to just focus and chill and just taking in your ideas and having no pressure to do anything. Wilmington is kind of still in the 90s or something. Which I feel like is great because a lot of people are rushing.
But he says there's a downside to Wilmington's slower pace as well.
Like when I think of like a rat or a mouse in a maze, Wilmington feels like a great place for the maze. But there's no cheese. There's nothing. A lot of people just get stuck in a loop, I feel like. Because there's nothing to do. There's a little bit of culture, but there's not a lot of culture. It's not much to look forward to. Everything closes early. I feel like if it was like an experiment that people were looking at, they would just want to see what do people do when they have nothing to do.
Smith says he plans to explore this theme in a future series. In Wilmington, Sophia Schmidt, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks to artist Aleem Smith and our Sophia Schmidt for enlightening us this week. Smith's art can be found online under the name Yesterday Night, with night spelled N-I-T-E. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributors John Hurdle and Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.